This week in Retronauts, Tales of the Pluckiest Hero of All. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. It's episode 419, and this week, as with many of the very recent weeks, we are talking about the 20th anniversary of something. In this case, we're skipping away from all that Xbox and PlayStation 2 stuff we've been doing lately to talk about the plucky upstart, the beloved underdog of the year 2001. That was Nintendo. Nintendo made video games. They made a brand new system in 2001, too, actually, and no one loved them, except us. And that's why we're here, to talk about the game that no one expected much of before it launched and yet turned out to be the greatest thing at the GameCube launch, and that is Pikmin, the Pikmin series. Actually, we might just talk about Pikmin 1. It kind of depends on how much we have to say. You know how it goes with my episodes. I put together a lot of notes and then we get like halfway through. So yes, if you are not familiar with this tendency, then you are new and you need to know that my name is Jeremy Parrish. I'm the host of this episode. And with me here in the same physical space, we have two people plus one remote. Why don't we go to the call-in participant first? Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Brian Auer, a longtime listener, first-time caller. I'm a streamer, podcaster, a lot of Nintendo stuff. I think I only stream stuff for the podcast, really. But yeah, I've been playing Nintendo games all my life, and we were a one-system household growing up, and you know, God damn it, if that wasn't going to be a system with a Mario game on it. So,
yeah. Which system was that to begin with?
To begin with? Oh, NES. Oh,
okay. So you go way back. Yeah. Way back before the Pikmin days.
Mario and I are about the same, or the NES and I are about the same age. So
got it.
Right. We came up together.
Understood. All right. And then here in this physical space, we have a regular, someone who's on a lot.
It's Henry Gilbert, and much like a red Pikmin, I am invulnerable to fire. But don't test that.
Yeah, I was going to say, there is a stove over here that I could try that out on. All right, staying in like beach paradise in Alameda, California. It's a whole hotel room built about 50 years ago, and it's like an apartment, and kind of smells a little bit like pee, but it's spacious and good for social distancing during a podcast. Anyway, also joining us and returning to Retronauts for the first time in quite a while, we have an occasional participant.
Yeah, hi, Wes Fenlon. I'm an editor for PC Gamer, but I'm a GameCube boy at heart. I grew up with the GameCube and did the occasional accidental mass murder in Pikmin, as we all did.
I'm glad you qualified that in Pikmin.
Only in Pikmin. That's my only mass murder. Yeah.
You never know. So
is there
are
a person who enjoyed killing Pikmin ever? I don't know if it's possible to...
I mean, that kid from Toy Story, I'm sure if he ever played Pikmin, he would have been all about
it. It's a test for sociopathy to playing Pikmin.
Yeah.
I guess so. Yeah, I think you're kind of almost like immunized from wanting to see Pikmin die because you have to put so much effort into cultivating them, growing them. Yeah, just like even if you have no emotions, if you are a horrible like puppy murderer, there's still, you know, kind of the sunk cost and time involved in creating these resources. And, you know, you can view them as resources. And so it's just wasteful to throw them all away. But, you know.
And then maybe that death sound really just twists the knife on you.
That's true.
It's really the ghost. Seeing their ghost as like, you're gone. I failed you. No.
You know, if this were
that's what I look for. Yeah.
If this were a Sega game, they'd all have little halos when they die. It would just be like a little Pikmin with a halo. But it's not a Sega game. It's a Nintendo game. And Pikmin debuted in October 2001 in Japan, about a month after the GameCube itself, and then showed up here in the U.S. at the end of the year, 2001, December, and about half a year later in Europe, because Nintendo is always that way with Europe. But, you know, prior to actually playing this game for the first time, did you know anything about it? Did you have any expectations for it? Was it something you followed? Yeah.
For me, the GameCube was the first system I bought with my own money. Like, I had a job and I'm buying a GameCube because, like, N64 came out when I was 14, got it as my 14th birthday gift. But, I was 19. So it was like, I'm going to buy this for me. I'm working at AMC theaters and I'm going to get it. And so, you know, I'm super primed for launch. And then I'm like, oh boy, in 2 weeks after this or 3 weeks after this, Pikmin's coming out. That's the next big game. Smash Brothers Melee. Sure, I'll probably play that some. But Pikmin's the next real game from Shigeru Miyamoto, and I cannot wait. And so, yeah, I was so pumped for it, like, pre-ordered it as soon as I could. And I remember, like, I was already a member of, like, the Nintendo Fun Club or whatever, and they sent me, like, a press release, like, hey, Pikmin, it's the next thing for Miyamoto. You should care. I was like, I do care. I do.
Interesting. I didn't realize. Yeah, I guess I had kind of checked out of Nintendo Fun Club quite some time before and kind of checked out of Nintendo with the N64, and the GameCube is what drew me back in. So I was like, I don't know what this is.
Now, yeah, as all my friends were talking up their, you know, Xbox and stuff, I had to be talked into buying only because all my friends were also playing Halo. And I was like, fine, I'll also get an Xbox, you jerks. But I was the one trying to pull all of them to the GameCube with me. But Pikmin really wasn't the best tool for that, though I still loved every second of it. When I'd show my friends, they would just go like, could you put back Super Monkey Ball or Smash Brothers? We want to play that.
I was obsessed with the GameCube in the months leading up to launch. I was in eighth grade, and so I was all about Rogue Squadron. I was like, this game looks photorealistic. It's amazing. And Smash Brothers, I was annoying the shit out of my friends. You know, every new issue of EGM that had a new screenshot or something of Melee, you know, I was super hyped on that. Pikmin, I don't think was really on my radar that much. Like, I knew about it, but I wasn't fiending to buy it. And I ended up getting it as sort of a surprise Christmas gift that year and ended up really, really loving it. Although, as we'll talk about, it was also like surprisingly, emotionally heavy game compared to what it looks like on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Brian?
I had Nintendo Power at this point. I think I got in right around the time the Game Boy Advance came out because I was just so ready for a Super Nintendo in my hand that I guess it had never occurred to me that Nintendo Power was a thing I could like subscribe to. Like I had like subscription to Disney Adventures when I was younger throughout the 90s, but I was like, Nintendo Power is an unattainable thing. I have to occasionally get an issue or that's it. But there were little blurbs here and there. They didn't really, it's a tough game to describe, especially when you don't know exactly what it's going to be, even though you're Nintendo's PR in America. Like, they still kind of are like, we don't know exactly what we're allowed to tell you because it's still changing. But, you know, you and your little plant guys are going to be best friends and are going to need each other. And that's going to be really important. So we'll say that about once a month in each issue.
I
wanted it, but I never ended up getting it. But I was very interested in the game. You know, I read those blurbs every month. So
I think too, by the time the game was coming out, I was aware of who Miyamoto was pretty well. And so,
yeah.
Especially like not just in Nintendo Power, but also I was real active on like the IGN Nintendo community on their boards and stuff. And everybody was talking up like, oh, well, you know who created Mario and Donkey Kong and Zelda? This is the next one from that guy. And so it's a big deal. And
Yellow Pikmin is the next beloved character from the Nintendo Pantheon.
This is kind of when that narrative became a thing, when everyone was like, Miyamoto is the guy who created Donkey Kong, Mario, Yoshi, Zelda. Like, like if you wanted to tell an adult or another kid who maybe didn't know as much about video games as you, you'd be like, this is the guy, man.
Yeah, he's that sort of I wouldn't say cult, but that sort of idea of the superstar of Nintendo really took off around the time of Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, because it was like, this is the dude, even though actually totally other people directed those games, but
yeah,
he was kind of seen as the godfather. So yeah, this was very much Nintendo saying like, hey, this is his next one. You're right. You're totally right about that. But, you know, for myself, I had, like I said, I'd kind of checked out of the Nintendo thing and occasionally picked up interesting looking releases for my N64, but I was really plugged into PlayStation, and that was where all my affections lay. But Game Boy Advance came out, and that kind of excited me. You know, it was like a portable NES, like you, or Super NES, like you said, Brian. And, I don't know. I looked at the next generation systems. I had PlayStation 2, and I felt like I could do one or the other. I could do GameCube or Xbox, and GameCube seemed like the natural choice because it was going to have Nintendo franchises, whereas Xbox had Halo from the guys who made Marathon that I loved, but that didn't seem like the one thing that would justify me buying an entire console. So I went with GameCube and got it over. I got a Japanese GameCube over Christmas 2001, I went to visit the girl I was dating, who was a jet working in Japan at the time. So she got me one of the cool Spice Orange Game Cubes, because you couldn't get those in America.
Oh, that's the dream.
That is the dream. And yeah, that was my birthday gift, or Christmas gift, sorry. So, you know, while I was over there visiting her, aside from being like, wow, Japan for the first time is so cool, I picked up, you know, a few games to go with it: Luigi's Mansion, Smash Brothers, and Pikmin. And Luigi's Mansion was the one I guess sank the most time into it first. And Smash Brothers, I tried to like, and I just can't do it. I can't enjoy those games. And then Pikmin, I picked up and was like, this seems interesting, but I don't think I get it. So it wasn't until a few months later that I went back and really revisited it, and that's when it kind of sunk its hooks into me, even though it was all in Japanese and I didn't totally understand everything I was doing. I still really enjoyed the experience of leading these little plant people around and you know, leading Captain Olimar to a terrible demise because I wasn't playing quite right. But the game was really surprising. Like, I kind of immediately recognized, oh, this is a real-time strategy game, but it's totally different than any other RTS I've ever seen or played. It's, you know, it's just unique. And it had such a great worldview. Like, literally, the world view that it presented was so appealing. And it really kind of took a different approach to visuals and aesthetics and art than just about anything else at the time. It was like the only game around then, you know, the early sort of second generation 3D systems that was simultaneously realistic yet also beautiful, as opposed to being like cartoonish and beautiful or realistic and extraordinarily muddy and dull. Like, they somehow managed to combine the best of cartoon aesthetics with a sense, like, you know, just really evoking a sense of place and of like, here is an actual physical space that you can exist in. And, you know, kind of bringing forward the almost like the sort of furtive realism that you saw in Wave Race 64 on N64, with the, like, the water physics and everything, where it just felt like, yeah, this isn't quite the usual from Nintendo. And this had that too, even though it was a totally different kind of game. It kind of created that sense of like, oh, this is like really unique and,
it's really hard
one
to
of
create
a kind of
that like
kind of
magical realism feeling, right? That's a very difficult vibe to hit. Most games, I think, either swing towards realism or magical, but they managed to thread it right in the middle.
Yeah, you didn't see a lot of games that kind of went macro like this. Like, they tried to present sort of the real world at scale. You know, like before Halo, Bungie made Oni, a martial arts action game heavily influenced by manga and anime, but for some reason they got the ElfQuest people to design the characters, and they're not Japanese. Anyway, the kind of big gimmick for that was like, hey, we're going to create real spaces. Like, we're having real industrial architects and interior designers design our levels for us, so they'll function like real world spaces. And it turns out that's incredibly boring. But that's what everyone was trying to do, was trying to, like, it's just not fun. It's not fun play spaces. You need, you know, you need to enter a big arena where there's like boxes that you can cover behind, like in Mass Effect, you know. It's kind of unrealistic, and it telegraphs what's going to happen in the space, but it makes for a better game. And so everyone was kind of chasing that, like, let's create the world and let you, you know, run around through this huge world. I mean, this game came out like 2 months after Grand Theft Auto 3. Okay. So that's, or Shenmue, you know, that's the kind of thing people were going for. And this said, let's create an extraordinarily tiny slice of the real world and then zoom in really closely. We're going to, you know, do the Chippendale Rescue Rangers thing or, micro machines or whatever, something you don't really see that often in video games, where it's just like, here's the real world, but, you know, the scale of things is totally different and it gives you a completely different perspective. And we can focus on something besides like making big rooms with, you know, doors that are twice the size of your character because perspectives and proportions are weird. And it's just like, here's like basically someone's backyard. And you were having an adventure against, you know, ravenous ladybugs. And it's amazing.
And it helps that it feels alive, too. Like, mm-hmm. the systems in the game all interact together in, like, kind of a natural way. And so it gives, like, almost credibility to the world. Like, it feels like this space is alive. And I think it's funny that the trend of gaming, like you said, to be more realistic or lived in space, like, I think it, in some ways, the FMV-ness, that whole era of we need things to be real, like real is what we want. We like, people want these to be interactive movies or something. Like, we realized that was dumb, but then polygonal graphics was like, well, now we can just build whatever we need. And they were still sort of missing the point there. It's not necessarily, you want to make something, someone feel like they're in that space and not just show them a space, almost like show, don't tell. Kind of thing.
The design style, like art design wise of it is always enrapture me, because it does feel like, you know, you're watching one of those National Geographic documentaries we saw as kids of like, here's super, super, super close up on like ants fighting a bee. And you just, because they're not human, they're not, you know, mammals. You see them tear each other apart and you, it makes you feel uncomfortable, but you're also like, well, I'm watching nature, you know. It's like, that's kind of how it feels in this game. Like, it's one of the most like violent games Miyamoto has ever had his name attached to, but I think it's this, it's both that it's the, you know, this insect world or insect, like this very close up world that it gets away with it, but also that characters have big googly eyes on them a lot of the time. And you're just like, well, look at this silly goofball. Oh, is this soul escaped from him? Oh, well, yeah. I killed that.
Everything has a death knell.
Yes.
I would love to know at what point in that design process, Miyamoto committed to that element of the game, because
they were working closely with Rare at that point.
The whole thing with Miyamoto and his gardening is I think it's based off of like the 30 to 60 seconds of stuff he said about it on stage at E3. And so like that gets brought up a lot, but I think there's not much out there in terms of interviews with the devs about how Pikmin 1 got made. Like, at some point, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but the Pikmin were going to be like the size of cats, and that was going to be the scale of things. But I think that the gardening just gave him an idea of what to shoot for as far as how small or large to make the world. You know, like with any Nintendo game, they spent a while trying to figure out how it should feel and what it should be, and let the purpose of the game kind of come to them as they played with it for a while. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The story of Miyamoto basing this game on his hobbies is one that gets thrown around a lot. And supposedly, you know, Henry mentioned bees fighting ants. And supposedly that was actually kind of the inspiration, was just watching lines of ants and him thinking, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to control like these ants, to, you know, to be able to interact with them. But also apparently I was reading on this, you know, to do the research for this episode, there's also a claim that this game was going to be about God helping Adam and Eve
yeah.
get started in the Garden of Eden, which
wild.
Was that also a hobby? Like, he was, you know, studying for the clergy. He spent some time at seminary and was like, I'm going to make a game based on this. I don't know. It's interesting that those are like two wildly contradicting ideas, but both of them have been kind of put out as the beginning of Pikmin.
It almost sounds like they just made a simulation and kind of watched it for a couple months just to watch something. But they couldn't figure out, at least from this story, I think they said it was from an interview with some Nintendo outfit in Brazil. I don't know, but it's poorly translated if it's real. And yeah, would he have been paying attention to like God games at this point?
Well, it's possible.
I mean, Sims was on in Super Nintendo. Like, he worked with Will Wright on
yeah.
that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think that's interesting that, you know, God game sim type things and RTS games, like, both didn't have a Nintendo franchise to that point. Like, it was both genres they hadn't really played around with. And so I could see Pikmin is like their answer to that too. Like, oh, this is unexplored territory for Nintendo as an internal developer. Like, well, what's our stamp on this kind of genre?
Yeah, you mentioned SimCity, but I would say a closer and more direct antecedent to this game on a Nintendo system would be from around the same period, which was Populous. The only game that I can really think of that comes to mind that has the sort of, like, you are leading followers, you know, across the landscape and building stuff, was really Populous. And yeah, I could definitely see, given that was an early Super NES title, where that would have had some influence. You also had like ActRaiser, which isn't anything like this, but you know, definitely Nintendo at the launch of Super NES, as you can see in my book, Super NES Works, Volume 1, sitting there on the coffee table. Like, that was kind of a thing at the beginning of the Super NES era. So, you know, that stuff sticks in the memory. And The Sims was growing and becoming popular around the same time. But also, there is another sort of line of influence on the creation of Pikmin, and that's Mario, specifically the Mario 128 demo that Nintendo yeah. showed in the N64 era. As you know, it was touted as, I think, people expected it to be the sequel to Super Mario 64, because what happens when you add 64 and 64, you get 128. So obviously, this is the next... This is the next Mario game. Mm-hmm. But then the next Mario game was actually Mario Sunshine, which had nothing to do with 128 Marios running around and jumping and going, woohoo! and really, Pikmin doesn't either. But, you know, the idea of having all these independently controlled objects, you can have up to 100 Pikmin out active at a time, which is getting pretty close to 128. So, you know, it's you kind of get the sense of, like, how that tech demo and the idea of, like, hey, you've got all these Marios, what do you do with them? Well, maybe you can't play each of them at a time. Maybe you control them sort of in a group and influence their controls and give them sort of indirect controls or commands and see how they act. How that would sort of migrate over to something that's not Mario, and maybe Mario's just in control, and maybe he's got, like, Goombas or something that he's controlling. But that doesn't make any sense. Why would Mario be controlling Goombas? Maybe it should be, like, you know, some other character. His name should be really similar to Mario. Maybe we could make his name Mario backward. Orima. That sounds good. Yeah, so let's do that. So you end up with Olimar and Pikmin, who kind of have the same scale and, you know, relationship to each other as Mario and Goombas, but it's something totally different in a completely different setting. It's science fiction, yet deeply grounded in like real world visuals. And, you know, like, you are, like I said, in someone's backyard, or, you know, in a creek back behind someone's house or something. And yeah, like all these things kind of come together. The God Game and Ants and Mario 128 and Adam and Eve. And then you have Pikmin.
I feel like those the kind of the first creatures you come across are some of the main ones you fight that kind of look like little ladybugs, but mm-hmm. with the googly eyes. They have big Goomba energy. Like mm-hmm. those are Goombas with a paint job, you know.
Right, and some of the Pikmin, you know, when they sprout, they grow leaves, kind of like Adam and Eve wore fig leaves to cover their shame. Ooh. Once they ate from the tree of knowledge.
I think you cracked it, Jeremy. Wow. You cracked
we've solved the Da Vinci Code. Move over.
That's an excellent reading.
Pikmin have no shame. It's true.
They wear their leaves in the wrong place. They're not covering anything.
The Pikmin name, I remember in those same early, like, 2001 promotional things for it. Like, they made sure to say, like, they had in a question in it, like, is this related to Pokemon? Because the name is so similar sounding. They had to go, like, this is nothing to do with Pokemon. Like, I wonder, like, how long Miyamoto had Pikmin in mind or whoever came up with it. And they're like, should we use this? It really sounds like Pokemon.
Yeah, they should be careful with those consonants, especially in, like, the late 90s.
You know, I was having a conversation, I want to say, with Bill Trinan a long, long time ago. It was someone at Nintendo Treehouse at some Nintendo event up in Seattle. And he mentioned that, like, the original name for Pikmin was going to be Pick-Pick the Vegetal Man. And I don't know. I have seen that elsewhere online, you know. There must be some truth to it. But yeah, I guess they combined Pikmin the vegetal man just down to Pikmin. Pikmin.
Well, was
he the vegetal man, or are the Pikmin themselves a vegetal man?
Pikmin was the vegetal man.
Pikmin, okay.
Yeah, well, Pikmin's the name of a brand of carrots from the game's, you know, universe or lore, so that's what he names him after, his favorite carrot brand.
Planet Hokkaidate, where Olimar has crash landed from.
So anyway, that's what we know about the origins of Pikmin.
If I could make one more guess, wild guess at where it came from, I do think that Miyamoto, you know, during the development of this game, since it was a GameCube launch game, between, you know, N64's launch and GameCube, he had ascended above like single game director or even like one studio director. He was like the president of the whole thing. So I do wonder if partially this game about managing a giant collective of characters comes from his new level of management that he went to from in the late 90s. Like
and you do have that boss named Kutaragi. So you just throw Nintendo employees at them and they die until you finally kill Kutaragi.
You're like, there'll be three more where they came from.
It's all making sense now.
There's a really interesting interview with a developer named Matoi Okamoto, who the interview is actually by Chris Kohler, friend of the show, from a few years ago. And he worked, Pikmin was one of the first games he worked on at Nintendo after joining the company at a pretty young age. And he didn't talk a lot about the ideas behind the game, but he did, he had a really interesting quote, which was Miyamoto saying, "The next Mario is Pikmin." And then it kind of his whole, he talked about Miyamoto's sort of like his philosophy while making this game was trying to decide on the balance between sort of classic, you know, game system mechanics and like just the idea of play and like art games that he was seeing at the time, like Doshin the Giant, which was, I think, still in development, and Cubivore, which is another very weird, tiny animal game that came out on the GameCube. And so he was trying to decide, you know, now we know where the RTS elements came from. That was him going, well, this game needs to, people need to see it, and it needs to make sense to them, and they need to be able to, you know, engage with it like a video game. But he also had this idea of sort of just a place where you can go and interact without you know, kind of hard guidance to what you're supposed to be doing and just enjoy the space.
And, you know, around the same time, Nintendo published Animal Crossing, Animal Forest for N64, like at the very, very end of the N64's life. I think it was like fall 2001. So pretty much the same time as this.
Yeah.
And that's a different kind of game, but there's still something... There's some sort of spiritual connection, I think, between Animal Crossing and Pikmin. And they're not by the same teams. Like, Miyamoto never promotes Animal Crossing. I don't know that he was really ever that involved in the series development. It's, you know, kind of a different group. It's not something that he's had a whole lot of direct involvement in, from my understanding. But yeah, it's like a different group kicking around the same ideas. You know, there's just something kind of floating in the water. And you also had, you know, talk about Mother 3 at the time that was going to be on N64 DD, and you're going to be able to plant an acorn and over time it would grow. And, you know, just the idea of nurturing and persistence and like creating something in a simulation view in the form of a genre, you know, in the wrapper of a genre that didn't really have anything to do with that style of game, with that style of mechanic. So... Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just you know, something that it was in the drinking water, you know, the water cooler at the office, and everyone all kind of drank from that font of inspiration.
I appreciate they had that push pull because I mean, this is still a thing in gaming now, but I think especially at that time, the idea of the technology was hyped up so much. You know, it was like, we can do, you know, 10,000 more polygons on screen a second and all this kind of stuff. And then you had at the other end of that, you had the Animal Crossings where it was like, what if we just simulated life and you could just live?
What if you wrote letters to your animal friends?
Well, the graphical power of it is on the GameCube, though. It's like, really, it's subtler. Like, the stuff it does, you could never do it on any system before it, but it didn't showcase the way, like, Metal Gear Solid 2 with raindrops blasting off of shoulders. You're like, whoa, look at that.
You can shoot ice cubes and then come back 5 minutes later and they're melted.
Yeah, or shooting a watermelon or whatever, but... Meanwhile, like, I could point to my friends, like, look how much that looks like a Duracell battery. Come on. Like,
how do they not have to pay for the brand rights?
Yeah, I was in full fanboy mode in these years. I think, like, the Nintendo Sega years, I was like, they're both fun. Sega's so bad. But I, for some reason, I got real bitter at Sony for for a little bit of my childhood. And I was like, no, guys, the GameCube's the best. Look how great this looks.
No, I felt the pain at the job I worked of telling people who were just like, hey, GTA's so cool. They were all talking about games. And then when I was like, yeah, let's talk games, you know, I even going like with Smash, they're like, what? Yeah, no, dork stuff. And Pikmin 2, like what you said there of how Miyamoto was saying internally, the next Mario is Pikmin. I do wonder how he feels that it wasn't, or like that it was never a real success. Like, not like Mario is.
I think it finally saw success last year when Pikmin 3 Deluxe came to Switch. But, you know, I do want to get to that comment about Pikmin being the next Mario, because... you know, just as we never got a Super Mario Brothers 4 here in America, we've also never gotten a Pikmin 4. All right, thanks everyone. That was my bit. but Pikmin kind of had the same relationship to the GameCube hardware that Mario 64 had to the N64 hardware, in that the controller is really perfectly suited and seems totally designed around playing Pikmin and maybe not much of anything else. I guess, unless you talk to a Melee fanatic.
Other
Mario Sunshine with the shoulder things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Smash doesn't feel right to me unless I have a GameCube controller in my hand. Even now, in 20 years later, it's like, can we put the adapter into the Switch, please? I want to play with the GameCube controllers. But yeah, I mean, it feels very perfect for Pikmin, which is then funny because, like, then by the time the remake of it, or the Wii version of Pikmin 1 came out, I was like, this might work better. I actually liked pointing with the wand and the nunchuck to the the GameCube controller.
Yeah, there were several GameCube series that came to Wii and actually worked better on Wii, and Metroid Prime and Pikmin were the big two. Like, both of those having the motion controls, the pointer, that really changed how the game plays. And I kind of wonder if they've been so slow to release Pikmin 4, which, you know, Pikmin 3 came out 8 years ago now, just because they can't really come up with a way that you know, a design, a concept that really harnesses the Switch's capabilities in a way that's as satisfying as the Wii pointer or the Wii U pad for Pikmin 3, or,
right,
you know, even the GameCube controller. Like, you know, the Switch has the potential for you to do motion controls, but then they also released the Switch Lite, which does not have the potential to do motion controls, because that's just nonsense.
Yeah.
So they can't really rely on the Joy-Con as pointer device concept for game design anymore. So I don't know. I feel like they're kind of struggling to figure out what to do with Pikmin 4, just in terms of, you know, like, how does it express the best of what the series is, live up to its predecessors, and also maximize the Switch.
It's kind of wild to think that when Pikmin came out, the sort of the way we understood you typically use a gamepad in a 3D game still wasn't really codified. And so Pikmin used the C-stick, if I remember right. You could kind of direct your Pikmin sort of in a weird, you know, just push them in this direction and kind of make them move like a wave. And I was just playing Pikmin 3 last night before we record the podcast, and noticed that the right stick now does the sort of understood traditional move the camera, you know, in 360 degrees. And I was like, this feels sort of a little wrong to me in my, I haven't played Pikmin in many years, but I sort of have this like built-in sense memory of how you can move the Pikmin with that stick, and you can't do that.
I absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had to unlearn it when I started playing Deluxe, and I eventually did. And I mean, I do love being able to move the camera with the second stick, as my brain also thinks, like, but I had to pretty much unlearn everything I learned from classic Pikmin. Yes.
Actually, why don't we talk about how the game plays? We've kind of given a general overview of the fact that it's, you know, like a macro view game where you control an alien astronaut who's like 3 inches tall. But you control Olimar, but he doesn't really do that much in the game. I kind of feel like, in a way, this precedes, you know, games like Dota and other MOBAs, where you have like the hero unit, and then you have all the sort of subordinate units that you're issuing commands to. And it's kind of like a strategy game from the hero's perspective.
That was a big change for RTS games, because everything up to that point was you're just, you know, the guy in the sky with 50 little tanks and men you can control with a mouse cursor.
And so we get to the ActRaiser thing again, where you come down from the sky, you manifest in the flesh as Olimar. And then you bark your commands directly instead of just, you know, issuing them from above by radio or whatever. But yeah, it was pretty different. Like I said, Populous kind of did that. But again, even there, you were still pretty much God, and you were like reshaping the land and things. And you would lead your armies around, but you weren't directly controlling an avatar in the game. They were just kind of doing stuff for you. Whereas this actually puts you down there, you know, with your legion. But Olimar, even though he has unique abilities, and he does have the ability to defend himself somewhat, it's pretty easy to get him into hot water if you don't keep him away from, especially like bosses. He has to kind of hover at the periphery and oversee, you know, the things that are happening and issue commands to the Pikmin who, you know, kind of collectively have much more power than he does. And so, mm-hmm. you know, he's unique, but he's also uniquely vulnerable in that, you know, if you lose 100 Pikmin, well, that sucks. You got to go get more Pikmin. But if you lose Olimar, that sucks because the game's over. You got to start again.
And you wasted a day, right? And we haven't really talked too much about the structure of the game, but losing a day is a big deal. And it comes with the guilt of, I think, all your Pikmin who were following you die. And so if you're stupid and get yourself knocked out, you just wasted the lives of, you know, 75 Pikmin or something. And, that hurts.
It's fairly likely that they were all of the Pikmin with flowers that you had.
They were your best. Yes. They were your top tier.
So you might have some buds in the onion, but, you know.
It's a massive setback. So I don't know if we should talk about Olimar first or the Pikmin.
Well, I like Olimar as a character. Like, he's, you know, a workaday guy. Like, he's just, you know, he's the basically a plumber of space, really, because he's like, oh, I owe a lot of money, or my company's going to... Their problems so much of the time are just like, this thing's broke, I got to fix it, or my company is gigantically in debt, or in three, it's like, my planet is starving, we got to go somewhere and harvest their food.
He's a truck driver, right?
Yeah. Each Pikmin game represent like
where
a concrete stage of capitalism? I feel like you could probably map that out between.
Maybe. I think it's more an indication of what was happening with Nintendo at the time. Like, you know, Pikmin 1, stuff's broken and you got to fix it. Pikmin 2, it's a desperate struggle to make a profit. And that was right after Nintendo had
announced... We need everything we can as fast as possible.
Yeah, that was right after Nintendo had announced its like first ever quarterly losses in since they entered the video game market. So
No, I mean, thematically, you have like, well, this is a launch game for the code name Dolphin, and the game starts with the SF Dolphin crashing, and you're like, ah, shit, we gotta rebuild the Dolphin, it's in trouble.
they saw it coming. All right, so we'll talk about Olimar then. I said that he was unique and had unique capabilities and is uniquely vulnerable. But he basically has three ways to interact with Pikmin. He can pluck or throw them because Pikmin are plants. So he plucks them out of the ground, and they're also small. So he throws them and they don't seem to mind. They just follow him around. They imprint on him and they're just like, you know, do whatever you want to his dad. It's fine. We're your little vegetable sons. We'll take anything that you throw at
us
or throw us at. Yeah, I don't want to get into the whole daddy thing. That changes the dynamic. Basically you come across Pikmin that are growing in the ground or have somehow been slammed back into the ground, as some enemies can do. And you use the gigantic button on the GameCube to stand near them and contextually take the action to pull them out of the ground, and then they follow you around like a little puppy.
Oh, that pluck sound is like one of the most satisfying sounds in a game to
me. It's like a cork pop.
And the hello noise that each Pikmin yells as they greet you.
Mm-hmm. Like, so I'm just born. Hello.
I'm ready to die for you, even though I am new in the world. But he can also throw them, and you use the cursor with the left stick, not the right stick, interestingly enough, to kind of target where you want to throw them. And you'll toss them, and you can toss them a certain height and distance. And it kind of varies according to the type of Pikmin you have. And then basically they'll land and do whatever they need to based on, you know, kind of what the situation is where you throw them to.
Yeah, what's nearby them.
Your other action you can take is to summon them, and... You know, your main action when you are not holding a Pikmin is to blow a whistle, and that calls the Pikmin into action. And they'll take different actions depending on, you know, again, the situation. There's a lot that's context-based in this game, and I think that's something people really... I think it's something about the game that goes underappreciated is the fact that it's so contextual. They took that, you know, the action button in Ocarina of Time... and just applied it to the entire world. Like, everything here is really kind of like, hey, the Pikmin will kind of figure out what they need to do. You just get them into the right place and, you know, organize the battalion properly.
There's a real elegance to that, the way you can really easily just intuit, like, okay, if I put a certain number of red Pikmin on this object that they're going to carry somewhere, you know, if the ratio is higher for one color than the other, they'll take it to their pod. If it's the other way around, they'll take it there. If I throw them at a wall, they're going to, you know, attack it. Like, I don't really remember having many experiences in that game being frustrated by what was happening and based on what I had done. It just, like, it all kind of just worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also probably a good game to play if you don't speak the language of the version you bought or whatever. Most of it could be conveyed to you if you just play it long enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and too, because that helps the alienness of the world you're in. Because, like, you know, Olimar doesn't speak the same language as the Pikmin. It's just all this, like, nonverbal communication. And it comes through in the design so well. Like, the whistle is another of my just favorite, just, like, bits in the game, because it, you know, it makes sense to, it feels pretty universal. Like, you understand, like, say in the military, or if you were a kid in school, you had a teacher that told you, like, everybody here, like, if they didn't have a whistle, they had something to get your attention. And it perfectly makes it like, yeah, the Pikmin are your little school children. And you're like, kids, come here. Like, And the intensity that you, sorry, I lost my thought on it, is like the intensity you hold down the B button when the whistle keeps going longer, like the way the lights on screen show, like, there's extra stress of, like, seriously, you're blowing this whistle so hard. Like, yeah, I love that.
I think it's from one of the Nintendo Power issues. I pulled a bunch of them just to see if there was anything, and there's not a whole lot. But I think it comes from one of those issues where Miyamoto said he put the whistle in there and they took it out for a little while, but he fought to get it back in because he's like, I think it will come across to everyone just what it means. It's to round up your forces. I think the team, I guess, maybe had some reservation about that being a universal thing, and he fought for it, I guess.
He was right.
Yeah, and I love that in the character model of Olimar and all the later leader characters, they all have to have a whistle put into their, you know, 1960s spaceman helmet. Like, there's a whistle in the front. Like, I also just love, yeah, it's like a real space age kind of design of the characters. Like, I mean, Miyamoto's a boomer. Like, he grew up in the space race era. And so Olimar and all the other human characters in it have these, like, ancient style of spaceman outfits, you know?
Well, and then in the next game where you get a second person and they use the whistle to kind of show that they're kind of a doofy idiot and to give them a wooden train choo-choo whistle.
I love that. I love this is number two we're talking about, but I love that they make Louis this idiot, and only as a way of, like, they're still making fun of Luigi in another game. They're like, well, yeah, the Olimar's idiot friend would be Louis, a guy with an L name who's, like, taller.
Such disrespect. Him.
Yeah,
this is the next Mario game, so yeah.
All right, so the other command that Olimar can issue, the other interaction he has, is to make them swarm, just gather together en masse and do stuff. And again, it's contextual. If they need to kill something, then they will just happily tear into that creature. And, you know, there's ways you can cause them to go after vulnerable spots. You're like, you know, go for the throat, or go for the eyeball, or go to the weak spot where Gregor Samsa got hit with the apple, like, kill that. And, you know, if they need to break down a wall, they'll just stand there and smash that rock wall with their heads until it falls. If they need to carry something, they'll pick it up. And, you know, if it needs to be carried by a lot of Pikmin, they'll just kind of patiently wait there until more Pikmin help them. You know, they're not very smart, but they're very sort of, I don't know. They can just kind of figure it out in the moment. They get what you're trying to tell them to do. And it's very rare in my experience with the Pikmin games to, you know, to have these sort of conflicting command spaces where you want them to do one thing, but they keep doing the wrong thing. I mean, occasionally it'll happen, but I think the world design, the level designs, I hate to call it levels because they're not really levels. It's the world. The world design is just so well structured, and objectives and hazards and obstacles are all placed so thoughtfully that there is this kind of separation between them. And so when you send your Pikmin, you know, to do things indirectly for you, they just do it. And so it really minimizes the frustration of trying to make these complicated things happen with 100 little characters following your commands. They just do what they need to.
Mm-hmm. Swarming was probably also the easiest way to get yourself in trouble, not because the Pikmin didn't follow your commands, but because maybe you weren't always giving them a great command, like accidentally sending 40 of your red Pikmin off a bridge into yep. the water where they've been drowned while screaming for your help.
Or when you thought you had your yellow, your red ones chosen, but you actually had the yellow ones chosen, and you send them towards a fire-breathing enemy who just roasts them instantly, and you just see all these yellow souls go up to Kevin, and you're like, God, I'm a monster, monster.
That's gonna psychically damage me for the next 20 years.
No, yeah. Literally, I beat one, and when two came out in 04, I got 5 hours in and I did that and killed like 40 yellow Pikmin. And I seriously did just go like, I'll play something else. It's too much.
Broken. Spirit broken.
I mean, that is definitely a turn of events where you're like, yeah, it's time to reset the system. I can't let this happen.
God can't know I did this.
I have to be a better God than this.
I'm always wary of the yellow Pikmin in this game because sometimes they're holding bombs. And so if you, depending on what state of rest they're in, sometimes when you call them over with the whistle, they will come over with their bomb. And sometimes they'll just drop them and kill all the Pikmin standing around them.
Yeah.
And so like you have to be real careful with the bomb guys. But for the most part, like the swarming, it's like probably my favorite verb in the game is the C-stick. I love using that thing to kill things or interact, you know, or just go completely into battle without thinking. Just, I've got 100 Pikmin and I've got a C-stick. I can make it.
Yeah, I feel like they didn't really want the right analog stick on the GameCube controller to be just like, you know, a typical analog controller. And this game really kind of expresses that, where you're not controlling the camera with it. You're performing specific commands and doing certain functions. They wanted it to be something other than just like, this is, you know, this makes the camera swing around, which is pretty much what it was on, you know, PlayStation dual analog games and PlayStation 2 games, and was going to be on Xbox. That's not what most people wanted. So yeah, that's what they moved away
but
from.
I feel like it also was a natural evolution of the N64 controller going from the C buttons.
Yeah. It's the same yellow as the C buttons for a reason.
Exactly. Yeah. Was C supposed to mean camera?
Camera, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So they were kind of like sort of admitting that this is probably what it's going to be used for, but like you say, they definitely wanted, they were, you know, they aspired to it being more than just that.
Yeah. And they sort of settled into the, I think the way that Nintendo was comfortable dealing with the camera was to have a button to shift it to your back by the end of the N64's life. And yeah, even the right or the left analog stick in on the GameCube resembles the N64's analog stick. And so I don't think they didn't make a dual stick controller because they thought that's what we should do now. I think that was just, it naturally came out, though. I always assumed, seeing the system before it launched, that control stick would click down and then you could, like in a Zelda game, select your weapon and then click the C stick to use the weapon. And was surprised when it didn't click at all.
Yeah, I think we're getting kind of into the weeds here, but
sorry. Yeah.
I feel like, you know, when they created the N64 controller, they put the C stick or the C buttons in there because it's going to be the camera and how you control the camera. And you see Mario 64, and that's exactly what happens. But because they didn't put a stick in there, it was buttons, people use those buttons for other purposes. And when it came time for the GameCube to roll around, they were like, well, you know, having this kind of button paradigm here is much more interesting than just having like a camera maneuvering thing. So let's, you know, let's just call it C, and hopefully it'll be more than just swinging the camera around. But then that's all it ended up being for most people, except, you know, like Metroid Prime and Pikmin.
Or Smash Brothers. Or,
you know, true. There's easy no camera smash in Smash move. Brothers. Yep.
Yeah, but you should couldn't get caught using the C stick, and people I played with, they would roast you.
I told my friends to deal with it. I was like, you know what? I'm using the C stick.
In addition to the commands we've talked about, Olimar can also take sort of nuanced actions. Like you can sort or cycle through different kinds of Pikmin. And, you know, you have the ability to very quickly separate them by color. Mm-hmm. Or if you pick one up that isn't right, you know, the right for your purposes, you can tap a button and it'll just kind of instantly replace it with the next Pikmin available that's, you know, kind of the alternate rank. So I guess at this point we should talk about colors and ranks, because talking about like segregating them by color sounds really bad when you just say it like that, and it's not that kind of
discussing game. This game is weird when you get into it. I've been streaming it a lot lately, and it feels uncomfortable sometimes when I'm describing my actions.
Think of it like the military. It's just like, you know, the right. that platoon
it's,
in that
it's Star Trek. You've got Command Gold, exactly. You've got Sciences Blue, and you've got Operations Red.
Mm-hmm. That's a little scary.
And the red shirts do die a lot, especially if you're near water.
Well, they're the muscle.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, it's very much about like function as opposed to like their genetics. So yeah, there's basically in this game essentially three colors of Pikmin. There's red, blue, and yellow. You just go in with the primaries, nice and simple. But each of them has its own capabilities. Each of them looks a little different than the others, and each of them has their own sort of weakness. Do you guys have a favorite?
I mean, they're all pretty similar looking, but I guess I like the ears on the yellow ones. Those are my favorite. They're little big ears. I'm glad I get why each game after this, they're like, well, you have to have a new Pikmin type. That's how you know it's a sequel, or you can add in all this new, you know, design stuff to it. But the simplicity of just yellow, blue, red, that's your three Pikmin to deal with. Like, I really like that, even though my favorite Pikmin is like the rock Pikmin from 3, like just design wise. It's just so cool looking. But, I guess I have to pick one. I go with yellow just because their ears are cute.
I think in the first game, it's blue for me after I had a water incident. I never felt quite fully comfortable with my red and yellow Pikmin with me, but the blue Pikmin, I was like, they can go swimming. No problem. Overall in the series, I love the purple Pikmin from Pikmin 2. Just the heavy thud Pikmin that you would throw at a wall to break it. Or I think they counted the weight of like 10 Pikmin or something like that. They were fun.
Yeah, not to make this whole color thing sound worse than it already is, but I really like the white Pikmin because they're so weird and so kind of creepy.
They're like poison, right?
Yeah, they're immune to poison, and then if enemies eat them, enemies get sick and die because they are poison. But they're like tiny, and they have these weird red eyes. They're kind of albino, but they're just a little like they look offbeat compared to all the other Pikmin.
Well, they're like weak too, like they're sickly.
They're super
like,
weak, yeah.
Yeah, but they can do all this stuff the other guys can't. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I've always been kind of partial to blue I'm kind of water element Pokemon I tend to lean toward that kind of stuff in games where that's like a choice or whatever, but also blue is just, it's relaxing because they won't drown. You can really move almost anywhere and still feel okay.
Hell yeah. Just don't get electrocuted.
Yeah. Or caught on fire.
I also love the yellow guys, the little dance they do when they complete a wire or they complete an electric current. Like, I like that animation a lot.
All right, so the red Pikmin are strong. They're like I think Henry said, they're the muscle. And they're immune to fire, like Henry said. The blue are not immune to fire, but they are immune to water. Any Pikmin will drown if you put it in water, but the blue do not drown. And what I really like about them is that if they are near a Pikmin of another color that's drowning, they're team players, and they will pull those Pikmin out and save them to keep them from drowning.
I did not remember that.
Which is not
that.
Something you don't see often. I can only think of having seen it once or twice, but when I was, you know, refreshing my memory, I was like, oh yeah, reading about this game, I was like, I do remember seeing that. And it's, you know, kind of an edge case. But again, it's that sort of contextual action that's been programmed into them. It's something you wouldn't have time to tell them, hey, go save those guys, but they just take care of it automatically. And then the yellow are interesting because their ears are like parasails. So when you throw them, they can fly higher and they take longer to land. And also they carry bombs, which, as Brian mentioned, can be very dangerous, but also very handy. Like when you send a yellow out to be just, you know, carry a bomb into the thick of a group of enemies. And I don't know how to say this, so it doesn't sound really bad. But yeah, like just take one for the team, I guess.
We salute your sacrifice, yellow Pikmin.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
You will be remembered forever.
Except they won't, because they don't have names. No. They're just little yellow guys.
But yeah, I mean, just like real life dynamite, you know, it can be useful as a tool, but you can't, it's nothing to play with, you know, it's dangerous.
That's right. Just ask Mr. Arst. So in addition to the color divisions, there's also three levels of maturity for Pikmin. So I guess at this point we should explain sort of the life cycle of a Pikmin, about how they are not born from a mother. They are born from an onion. And an onion is like a tiny spaceship that is also a plant.
With very long, spindly legs that serve its landing gear.
Their life cycle is a little bit like the Xenomorph from the Aliens movie, in that it involves like multiple creatures and phases. Like the onion is kind of the egg and the facehugger. And then the Pikmin, I guess, is like the actual Xenomorph. And the facehugger just exists to impregnate a person and die. And the onion is just there to like spawn Pikmin. But at no point do you see a Pikmin grow into an onion.
Is the onion alive itself?
I don't know. There's much of this game that is not explained.
In the third one. It's they kind of animate it a little more. And it's a little unsettling when its legs come out.
I also like they kind of almost leave like a crop circle type thing. Like it feels like, mm-hmm. you know, it's yeah. a UFO landing every mm-hmm. time it does it, which I just love. And yeah, the little, I mean, they are like spores, like, or like, you know, from a dandelion or whatever, just flying off. They just float down to the ground.
You know, yeah. Olimar assumes that the Pikmin are native to the planet he discovers them on, but what if they're an invasive species, just like the alien?
True.
I mean,
like
who knows where that onion's from.
Well, who knows what they're keeping down?
I mean, they seem to exist to kill the native fauna of a planet and then turn it into more Pikmin. So that certainly is how you describe it, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't seem to know how effective they could be, though.
Mm-hmm. Right. This
they need
world,
a strong leader to express
exactly.
their power.
This world is very clearly like the human world, probably like Japan, but you never see humans. It seems to be after an apocalypse. So are Pikmin, like, what caused humanity's extinction? Like, there's a lot of questions, and when you really start to look at the series, it kind of makes you a little uncomfortable. Anyway, so basically, the onion is, it's kind of like a UFO on spindly legs, like a spider that flies, and it has kind of, you know, a UFO beam to it. So the Pikmin, when they get resources, like food resources, they will take it back to the onion and drop it beneath the onion, and then it will beam that resource up with its UFO tractor beam and absorb it, and then spit out little baby Pikmin, like little seeds. And those will flutter down to the ground, and they'll plant, and then the next day you can come. Actually, it doesn't even take that long. It's pretty quick. You can pluck them right away. But if you wait longer, then they will mature. So if you wait like 2 days, they'll be fully matured as opposed to just little buds. And there is a...
I think it's only like half a day to get a full flower.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's a quarter day amount for each upgrade.
But it's slow enough that you don't want to just hang around because you do have a time limit. So you can't just be like, oh, I'm just going to kill some hours here. Was that Henry?
No, I would just say, boy, do you have a time limit in this game. Like,
Yeah, so you know there is the potential to just immediately pluck the Pikmin that are planted, and if you're really low on you know your numbers, that might be the way to go. But if not, then it's good to kind of let them mature and ripen, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you have ways to make Pikmin mature in the field. Like if they find nectar just sitting around, they'll automatically run over to it and drink it, and that will cause them to basically level up. But you know, the different levels, there's, what are they? Leaf, bud, and bloom. Those represent different levels of strength. So like leaf is basically a baby and it is slow and weak and kind of stupid like a baby. whereas bloom is, you know, athletic prime. It's, you know, fast, powerful, smart, will take actions and execute them quickly.
They don't fall behind.
Right. Yes, and that's always a big problem is like you're leading your little army around and the slow ones lag behind. And if they lag far enough behind, they just kind of stop. They're like, well, we give up. We don't know what's happening. And so then you have to waste time hunting them down and trying to find them. So,
am I misremembering or could the blooms on like the yellow and the blue Pikmin, could they get burned off if they caught on fire? Would they like de-level?
Yeah, they can get or hit really hard by an enemy or a boss or something like that. And
yeah, the petals are just gone. Yeah.
Yeah. If they go through something crazy.
Yeah.
Also, they I think in that instance, that's what causes them to plant new Pikmin where like during a crazy battle, if they die or you know, get hurt or something like that.
Oh, that explains that. Yeah, imagine getting hit so hard that you have to go through puberty again. that's quite a punch.
I suppose the Pikmin are deflowered in a way.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. Ooh.
It's more like they're reflowered, though.
Yeah.
I don't know where we're going with that. All right. There's just, this whole, like, nature documentary thing, it really leads to some weird and uncomfortable conversations. but basically the Pikmin, like they are kind of the stars of the game. Even though you control Olimar, you spend all your time like caring for your Pikmin, trying to grow new ones, trying to mature the ones you have, trying to protect the ones that are out with you, you know, putting whatever extra you can sprout into reserve in the onion so that they'll be safe. And yeah, it is a resource management game, and the Pikmin themselves are probably the biggest resource you have. Like, they're the most important by far.
You know, I bet at some point when they were working on the design that they probably let Olimar carry at least some objects in the world or interact with something. Mm. And I'm sure it was a very deliberate choice to go, no, we are not going to let him do basically anything except control the Pikmin. Because you can, like, headbutt stuff, right? And that's about it.
And if you're really desperate and all of your Pikmin are doing a certain task and you can have him help knock his head up against the wall and do little bits, but it's not going to get you very far.
Yeah. And if like a Bulbourb is like the small ones are coming after your Pikmin and making a mess of things, you can run in and like headbutt a Bulbourb, and that'll, you know, either make it stop or even kill it, depending on the size and how weak it is. But it's desperate because
pellets down.
Yeah, you have a very limited amount of health, and they can hit you back.
When the limited scope of Olimar really helps it too with the resource management thing, because, you know, you do have the resources of like just your number of Pikmin, and also it's like, well, you better collect these items to rebuild the ship. And of course you can kill guys and then consume them to make more Pikmin. But it's not like in, you know, contemporary RTSs from the time where it's like, well, I better keep checking on my gold farms or on that one big project in town. And also you can't, you know, because you're always with Olimar, you can't zoom out all the way. It's something the later games, you know, 2 and then 3 even more so, where you can have your different parties of like, okay, what's going on over there? Those guys were building a bridge while I was doing this. Oh, the bridge is done. Like, but in 1, you're just very focused on your one group through Olimar's viewpoint.
And you do have the ability to kind of set them to different tasks and statuses. You can have Pikmin wait in a place for a while, which, you know, you want to be sure it's a safe place before you do that, because otherwise enemies will find them and just devour them while you're like, oh, wow, I just lost a lot of Pikmin and I don't know why. But you can kind of put them in a neutral position. And, you know, if they complete a task or something changes that they don't know how to deal with, then they'll enter that neutral position. So you kind of have to keep an eye on where they are. But, you know, you spend time kind of delegating tasks according to the Pikmin's abilities. But also, you know, when you send food resources back to the onions, you want to kind of look and see which type of Pikmin do I need the most of, because the color of Pikmin that carry the food resources back to the onion determines the kind of Pikmin that are sprouted. So, you know, that kind of creates a push and pull also. Like if you're low on a certain type of Pikmin, you want those that you do have to carry back resources to the onion. But at the same time, can you afford to spare the ones you have in your party because you have so few of them? You have to make choices like that kind of on the fly.
Yeah. Also, you got to make sure you're not just running around the world randomly and sending Pikmin back just with stuff because you need it. You got to make sure that you have cleared out that path. Keep an eye on which way they take, because sometimes they're either a door will be up, or they just decide to go that way because they wanted to. But you could be in a position where you send a bunch of Pikmin back with resources and you forgot about one fire dude and he's just lit up all your blue Pikmin. And that's the end of them.
So there's a lot of kind of a need to keep an eye on things, but at the same time, Pikmin does tend to be a sort of leisurely paced game. It can have its moments of stress and anxiety for sure, but it feels like it's a game that, unlike most RTSs, is not frantic all the time. It's not a constant race to build your resources and try to get into that feedback loop before the other player. And that's a function of the fact that it is not a competitive RTS. That kind of would show up as an option in some of the sequels as a bonus mode. But Pikmin itself is a, you know, described by Nintendo, but described by Miyamoto, I think, as an RTS about cooperation. And you're not cooperating with another player in the first game, but you are cooperating with your teammates, the Pikmin themselves. And it's about everyone kind of pulling together and working toward a common task. And that common task, which we haven't really talked about, is finding all the parts of Olimar's ship, the Dolphin, which, you know, it crashed and it scattered all its bits all over the place. And you have 30 days to gather them all, repair your ship, and leave the planet, or else you'll run out of oxygen and die. So there is like this kind of intense background stress of like, wow, I only have X many days and I've still got Y number of parts to find. But it's really more about kind of managing your time and figuring out what the best approach is to venture out into the world and search for resources and how to allocate your Pikmin party and so forth.
Mm-hmm. It ends up being really foreboding for a game that otherwise seems very kid-friendly. You know, the further you get into Olimar's adventure, every day he writes this diary entry, and the closer you get to the end of your 30-day window, the more he's talking about missing his kids and his wife and whether he's going to ever see them again. And, like, it gets pretty dire, and mm-hmm. you know he's going to try to take off at the end, regardless of the state his ship is in. And he keeps saying, you know, well, I might be able to make it out with only some of the ship parts. I probably don't need all of them, right? But I don't think it's ever clear to the player which ones you can miss. Like, the game doesn't explicitly tell you that, I don't think. So there is sort of this potential chance of you launching at the end of the game with, like, maybe you have the parts you need, or maybe you're going to explode as you leave the orbit.
After you either successfully escape the planet or hit day 30, it will show you a screen of all of the pieces that you'd found. And there are five. And I believe it denotes in some way that these are the five pieces you may not need. But I think it will only tell you that if you found it and collected it and get to the end.
I feel like this is not a game you're meant to finish the first time through. I think, you know, it's kind of understood. They give you multiple endings, and it's meant to be sort of an incentive to go back and try again, which is a little bit of an old school concept. But, you know, I think it works here because it's not a super time consuming game. You have 30 in-game days, and each of them is maybe like 12 to 15 minutes long. So what is that? That's like 7 hours, 6 to 7 hours.
I think they're 20 minute long, so you get like an even 10 hours, okay. Maybe.
I don't think they're that long. It doesn't feel like they're that long, no. But what do I know? Maybe I just get absorbed.
They go quickly, for sure.
But yeah, time moves fast.
The intensity of the looming deadline definitely stuck with me in the game, and like the yeah, I think the localization, like Wes was talking about, like, or the script and then well localized, really expresses like that the intensity that this goofy little character is feeling. And then by the end of it, you know, maybe that also feels like kind of a space race kind of thing. Like, well, is the Apollo going to make it to the moon or whatever? Ooh, let's watch. And so when you lift off in your rickety rebuilt ship, you're like, I hope I got everything. And I think on my first playthrough, I got a good enough ending. It definitely wasn't the bad ending. I know that. But I think I played through it at least one more time. But then eventually I was like, wait, it's the year 2002. I can just look up the best ending on the internet. Yeah.
Yeah, the endings are pretty dark no matter what happens. If, you know, get the worst ending, Olimar crashes rather than escaping from the planet, and the Pikmin take his corpse to the Onion and feed him to the Onion, and then he sprouts an Olimar Pikmin with like a Pikmin body and an Olimar head, which, like, it's really kind of a little upsetting. But if you get the best ending, which is to find all the parts of the dolphin, including the secret bank vault where his money is, and then leave before the 30 days is up, then you fly away, but you leave behind Pikmin that you've taught to kill. Like, you've fed their bloodlust and awakened it, and they just like go out on their own and beat the shit out of Bulborbs or whatever. They're just like out there in a murder rampage, and then the Onions like fly away and leave the planet. So it's, you know, have you started some sort of interplanetary pariah? Like, is the galaxy going to become consumed and transformed into Pikmin?
It's like the lesson of a Bug's Life, but like taken to the fullest extent.
Wow.
I think that bad ending is sweet in a way. Like, obviously, you know, Olimar's dead, that's sad. But the Pikmin are like,
what do we do with dead things?
Yeah, it's like, we know what to do with this guy, and hey, now you're one of us. Hey, we can just be Pikmin forever here. Hey,
welcome back, Dad.
That really should have been a skin for him in Smash Bros.
Yeah.
I don't think
they didn't tie into that. Yeah.
してくれとは言わないよ。Okay. No one had anything more to go. We're actually kind of running low on time. We're at an hour 20 already. So I don't think we are going to be able to make it to the sequels this time. But that's okay. When and if Pikmin 4 ever comes out, all of these games will be retro. Maybe even Hey Pikmin. Hey You Pikmin, whatever it's called.
Well, there was one thing I wanted to mention. Yes. With the first game, though, which was the hit song in Japan that was related to it. So for the commercials for Pikmin in Japan when it first released, there was a song by the group Strawberry Flower called Ai no Uta, meaning Song of Love, which is just this really sweet little song, like kind of folksy, that is the lyrically about the life of a Pikmin, about this, you know, unending devotion to somebody, and like that we're going to keep trying together, and when we get consumed, we'll just come back and we'll work with you again. And it's just such a beautiful song. I just really love it. Like when the game came out in the US, I'd already been hearing about the song online of like, oh, this is a hit song. You know, the GameCube's not selling great in Japan, but boy, this song sells like gangbusters. And yeah, just pulling it up again, I just really love it. Like, look up the lyrics and you can see how it really was written about, you know, being a Pikmin. And it's this song of like, devotion to a person through like life and death and the cycle of death and rebirth. And the song, you know, then in Pikmin 2, it never appears in the game Pikmin, but in Pikmin 2, if you get 20 of every type together in your 100 set, you know, they will sing this song. Like they will sing. I know.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, And also the song is it's definitely in Brawl, I believe. And so yeah, I think they made like a sequel song to it for Pikmin 2 that's not as good, but yeah, there's the music video that's like the most viewed version of it on YouTube is a really nice little AMV for it. But yeah, Ai no Uta is a really sweet song. You know, in America, it didn't get around all that much, but it's, I always, when I think of Pikmin and the cycle of life they go through in this game, I think of this song.
That's really cute. For me, I think my favorite thing in all of the Pikmin series is the ads that they made for Pikmin 2, just mm-hmm. like the magazine ads, and as well the cover of the game, I believe, where they used claymation mm-hmm. or they made little tiny models. They're so gorgeous and cute little designs that they put together. I hope someday, if there's a Pikmin 4 or maybe a Pikmin 5, who knows, that they go back to that style in the same way that Nintendo has done, like, Yoshi's Woolly World, and, you know, kind of taken the textures of real objects and built a game aesthetic around them. I think Pikmin would look so cool if they use that aesthetic in the actual game.
Yeah. I really love the Japanese packaging and marketing for Pikmin, because it really focuses on just the characters. It's always very simple with, like, you know, solid colors that are, they're not primaries, but they're kind of like slightly off primary. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the American covers, it's just like, here's a render of Pikmin being eaten by a Bulborb. Yeah. it tries to make it exciting and violent. Whereas in Japan, it's just like, here's these cute little flower people. Look at them standing here, staring plaintively at you. Don't you want to lead them? And to me, that's way more effective. It's intriguing. It's like, who are these little, like, they're kind of like alien looking, but they also have like a flower on their head. What's up with this?
And their little puppy dog eyes begging you for help. Yeah, I mean, that's not surprising in America. They're like, oh, it's a fight to the death. Like, it's
action.
Yeah.
Now Pikmin have angry eyes.
Also, when we talk about the heartbreak of these Pikmin games, I forgot to mention that like the way they show you of like, hey, you left some Pikmin behind and you're going to watch them get eaten right now.
Yeah.
Every day at sunset.
Yeah.
The Bulborbs come out for a snack and you feel sad and guilty.
Yeah, because they're just running around like, hey, where'd everybody go? Ah!
And you can't skip that cutscene.
Nope.
In two, they both give you more ways to be depressed and also give you ways to skip that depression. So you can skip that them getting eaten cutscene, the death count is on a different screen, but if you flip over to it, it will tell you an itemized list of all the different ways your Pikmin could have and maybe did die that day. And so, yeah, they let you get as into that or avoid it as much as you want, really.
I have strong memories from that first game of, you know, kind of overreaching with my my multitasking and just running as fast as I could as the last 10 seconds counted down to get back to my group of Pikmin just to whistle for them so that they were, you know, in my party and then they would survive, and, you know, being feet away when the time ran out, which just meant, you know, dozens of them were just going to be left to die on the planet's surface at night. Really, really gutting.
Yeah.
It's a game full of hard lessons.
I think there's something to be said about the Nintendo's two, well, I mean, Smash Brothers 2, but Nintendo's two, like, big launch games on the GameCube were both pretty short, but felt like run-based games where you get to the end of Luigi's Mansion and be like, I could do better than better than that. You could make your numbers go up. You could find more money or more treasure or whatever, get a better grade. Whereas in Pikmin, it's kind of like a less than 10-hour game if you look at it like that. And you can make all your numbers go down. You could do it in less number of days or lose less Pikmin or, you know, some metric, you know, in that way. So, but yeah, they were both pretty short. You know, I don't know if that was because of the memory on the little disc or just they needed a game out. But they both feel like they're complete games.
I think sometimes a game just doesn't need to be 50 hours long. Sometimes 7 or 8 hours is just the right length for a game.
That's not what market research says, Jeremy.
Oh, well, you know, market research says so. You know, we also need an Atari Lynx that's like 70% empty air because it has to be huge.
And if your box doesn't say multiplayer on the back around this time,
and
then
RPG
you're in
elements.
Trouble.
Yep. Yep.
Now that I hope it's not the end for Pikmin. I think especially once they could get into HD era, it's like, wow, the level of detail like exponentially increased with that. Like it's
Pikmin 3 is beautiful.
And the
fruit juice. Like, every time I play that game, I'm just like, I need to drink fruit juice now. And it's so good. It's like, it has the same effect on me that Ratatouille does with cheese. I'm just like, I need some of this in my body. Thank you.
But I've heard the Pikmin are alive and well, even in the real world, because at the Super Nintendo World theme park, you know how in Disneyland there's hidden Mickeys around and stuff? Apparently in the one in Osaka, there's hidden Pikmin around in the world of Super Nintendo.
Not hidden Luigi's? Has that ship sailed?
Luigi's right in your face. Like although there are other secrets there too. I don't want to spoil secrets for
people.
Yes,
please don't.
Before they go there, but there's lots. But you will
God
find
God knows when we'll be able to
Pikmin.
Go to Japan, but whatever.
Yeah.
I think Pikmin would be amazingly, it would be ripe for a full Pikmin land at Nintendo World where they scale everything up, you know, 50x. That would be really fun.
I like it. But, you know, Nintendo has said Pikmin 4 is nearly done.
In 2015.
Yeah, that was like 6 years ago. So, you know, that's just a lot of polish they're doing, I'm sure.
As long as Arzest isn't making it, I'm fine with that.
They're not allowed to make anything ever. I think that's going to wrap it up. So, thank you, gentlemen, for talking about Pikmin with me. We did not make it to Pikmin 2, but this should not come as a surprise. That's how it always happens. I'm so glad I put together all those notes.
The day ended too early.
Yeah, exactly, right? We had to make it back to the ship or all my guests get eaten. So, guests, let me give the usual spiel, and then I'll let you give your own spiels. This has been a Retronauts podcast, which you can find at retronauts.com, on various podcatchers, And of course, at patreon.com/retronauts, where you can support the show. We are pretty much entirely community supported through subscriptions via Patreon. It allows us to make shows. It allows us to get together and talk in person and have a nice casual conversation as opposed to a strained conversation that's internet only. It allows us to hire cool people to help out, to create artwork and edit podcasts for us and co-host the show and so on and so forth. So that's a good reason to support the show. It makes the show happen. You can find that at patreon.com/retronauts for $3 a month. You get access to each show a week early in a higher bitrate than on the public feed and without advertisements or cross promotions. For $5 a month, you also get 2 exclusive podcasts each month. You get a mini podcast each weekend by Diamond Fight, along with an accompanying text column. You get Discord access. It's pretty much the best deal in podcasting, so I highly recommend it. Patreon.com/Retronauts. Wes, what about you? Where can we find your stuff?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Wesley Fenlon, and you can find me in the pages of PC Gamer Magazine. There's also a website.
Brian, how about you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitch and Twitter at Luigi's Apartment, and I've got a new show I've been working on with Brad Ward from the Greenlit Podcast Network's Brad Ward. We've just put together a show called Need for Speed Running with Spike Vegeta and Jay Hobbs from Games Done Quick, where we pick a speed run, talk about it, kind of introduce the mechanics, and then watch it and break it down further and just kind of hang out. It's been a lot of fun. So we've got Ratchet and Clank 3 run that's going to be up later this month in a couple weeks. So actually in a week, I should get on that. And also my other show that I've been doing for years is Chat of the Wild, which is a Legend of Zelda book club, game club podcast, where we've been going through the series in chronological order, usually one dungeon per episode, kind of breaking down how the games fit together and work and stuff. So we've done most of the series at this point. In fact, right now, our patrons unlocked a review of the cartoon show, which is currently our side project, and it's that's really rough. I don't know who that show wasn't made for anyone. It's kind of tragic. I think the only person that show was for is Bob Forward, who had a lifelong fantasy of being Robin Hood with a gun, so he made that cartoon. But yeah, follow me on Luigi's Apartment.
All right, and Henry, that guy over there.
Hey, yes. Hey, if you enjoy hearing me on this podcast, I host several podcasts released all the time. So me and Bob Mackey, the other co-host on Retronauts, we do the Talking Simpsons podcast where we go chronologically through the entirety of The Simpsons. Right now, we're nearing the end of season 12 and the end of season 2 at the same time. And it's a fun back and forth between 1991 and 2001. Also, we do the What a Cartoon podcast where we cover an animated series twice a month, super in-depth, going into its history. Jeremy has been on several of them. We did a Bubblegum Crisis
one. Time.
We did G.I. Joe, The Max. Those are just the Jeremy episodes. So many other great ones. And on patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons, that's where we're supported, where we offer a ton of extras, including we're doing our 10 favorite episodes of Batman, the animated series. We are having a whole lot of fun talking about old Batman. We love it. And we do the What a Cartoon Movie podcast for extra premium patrons. Hear us talk about the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Rankin Bass special just in time for the holidays. That's all. Patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. And please follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG. I am certainly tweeting about Nintendo-related products. I probably, as you're listening to this, I would guess SMT5 or Advance Wars. I'm probably playing quite a lot of that.
Yeah, that would seem likely.
I can't wait. Jeremy, you're going to commit to a Retronauts about Advance Wars, the remake right now, right?
That's a patron request if you're subscribing at that level. Okay. Okay, so anyway, you can finally find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite. You can check out my YouTube channel. It's called Jeremy Parrish, and I cover a lot of Nintendo and Sega stuff. Every week, a different video about the chronology of those companies' game systems. And, of course, I'm doing stuff at limitedrungames.com, including publishing books and writing stuff for games and so forth. Yeah, we're all busy people. So we still felt the need to take the time to come together and talk about Pikmin because it's great. We love it. And now the sun has set and we got to get back to our onion. It sounds delicious.